Some of my plants this spring have brown leaves, and plant this says, well, you need to water them more. But I've been watering them, and they have a lot of rain lately. Maybe it's not the lack of water. Maybe I over-fertilize them. This week on Thrive in the Future, I talk with Sam Baker from Wriggle Brew, and we talk about soil health, and we also talk about nitrogen poisoning and over-fertilizing and how Wriggle Brew can help. That's this week on Thrive in the Future. Welcome to Thrive in the Future podcast, positive solutions to help you thrive, designing your intentional life, homesteading, gardening, and rediscovering culture and tradition. Hey, times are tough. You want to be more self-sufficient and grow more food with even enough to share with family and friends or to sell some of that surplus. You've heard about this food forest thing, but it's also overwhelming to get started. I can help. My thriving food forest design can help you realize your dreams of an edible foodscape or a perennial paradise that'll come back every year so you could grow more food and be more self-sufficient. Schedule your free discovery call with me at thrivingfoodforest.com.
Welcome back to Thrive in the Future. This week, I have Sam Baker with me from Wriggle Brew. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you for having me, Scott. I'm ready to talk worms.
Sure. So tell me a little bit about yourself and then a little bit about Wriggle Brew. And it is Wriggle Brew, Wriggle. Not Wiggle Brew.
Yes. It's a tongue twister. Wriggle with an R.
Uh-huh.
So I run Wriggle Brew. I'm the CEO, manager, owner, operator, and with a couple other guys. This originally started as a research project out of the University of Central Florida. And it spun completely out of control. And what we do is we produce earthworm castings. So that's worm poop, if you're not familiar. And we take that and we make Wriggle Brew, the worm poop juice, the earthworm tea, which we sell to farmers, big and small, from row crop soy agriculture all the way to large cattle farms to backyard gardeners and everybody in between. And we do that because we want to have a fertilizer on the market that's much better for the environment and is much more impactful for regenerative agriculture than a lot of the current stuff out there.
How is Wriggle Brew different than regular old worm castings that I go down and get from Home Depot or something like that?
So there's a couple major differences. One, we actually have a special diet basically for our worms. Hmm. So with worms, like any other organism, what you put in affects what comes out. Really? So if I feed you nothing but McDonald's cheeseburgers, you probably won't produce the finest human manure there ever was. The same thing applies to earthworms. If you feed them nothing but, you know, peat or grass clippings, you're not going to get the best quality stuff. So we have a special diet, essentially, that the earthworms are on. But more important than that, we don't just sell the worm castings. In fact, our main product is Wriggle Brew. It is a worm casting tea. It's a liquid application. And that has several important distinctions to it. But the big one is that it is a liquid that can be applied both directly to already growing plants or into systems that farmers or large agricultural conglomerates are currently using. Mm-hmm. So you may or may not know this, but a lot of the organic fertilizer options out there are not liquids. They're manures. And those that are liquids, many of them are things like compost teas, and they have no shelf life. The average compost tea or worm tea has a shelf life of 24 to 48 hours.
Really?
That is so, so short. That is logistically impossible. We managed to find a way to keep the worm tea shelf stable without impacting its actual performance. And in fact, we found ways to boost the performance of the worm tea along the way. So we can provide something like a compost tea or worm tea on an industrial scale without it going bad before it gets to the farmer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so you're also doing a pretty large scale for big farms too?
Yes. So, for example, this last season, we put out over 30,000 gallons, which is like a small pool, basically, which is enough to cover well over 10,000 acres. It's a very significant quantity. And we've been selling that, like I said, to row crop farmers. So people doing soy on thousands of acres of farmland. Mm-hmm. And they're using this. It's reducing their nitrogen load. So it's taking the amount of nitrogen they're using down. It's saving them on cost because worm teas are made here in the United States from organic food waste, not from petrochemicals shipped in across the ocean. And most critically, it is having a really beneficial impact on the environment around that farm where it's regenerating the soil rather than degrading it.
Right. So how do you do that since for the most part, their soil is addicted to 10, 10, 10, right?
Yeah. So it's a lot of trying to reduce their nitrogen phosphorus output. Mm-hmm. So nitrogen and phosphorus are very reactive when they are in our soil in a soluble form. So they act as a kind of a free radical. They're ripping their way through the cell walls of bacteria, through fungi, through a lot of these beneficial organisms. If we can take their nitrogen use per acre down by even a few pounds, but ideally like 100 pounds down per acre or something, then we're talking about a significantly decreased quantity of nitrogen ions and phosphorus ions flowing through that soil, killing organisms. Now, the worm tea is also full of these beneficial microorganisms. It's absolutely chock full of all kinds of bacillus species. And so these guys are coming into the soil, and it may be slightly nuked by the prior application of nitrogen. But once you bring in these guys, they're going to rapidly start to colonize that soil and start to build it back up again. So it's not just replacing the nitrogen with something that isn't going to destroy the soil, but it's bringing in through the worm castings a new population of soil microbes so that now we are regenerating the soil so that the next season around, the farmer doesn't need to use more fertilizer. He can actually potentially get by on less. Which, you know, maybe that doesn't sound like the best business model from our end, but it means a happy farmer, and a happy farmer is a returning customer, even if it's slightly less gallonage than it was the year before.
Right. And so your worm tea also has the bacteria. Does it also have a mycorrhizal in it?
Yes. So we got trichoderma. We have all kinds of endo and ectomycorrhiza. And that's, you're touching on a very important part, because that's really one of the keys to what makes compost teas and worm teas so powerful, is it's not just, oh, it has humic acid in it. Oh, it has fulvic acid or gibberellic acid. It has life in it, soil mm-hmm. life. And that is extraordinarily important, because when you don't have that soil life, you don't have anything. You just have some nice dirt, or maybe some nice dirt juice. And that's better than maybe petrochemical nitrogen or anhydrous nitrogen, but it's still not where it should be. To have proper growth, we need humus. We need living topsoil. And that comes from microbial life. So we make sure that the wriggle is brewed. It's brewed in with all of our microbial life to make sure that it's got a solid punch to it. But that's also the technical challenge of making it shelf stable, because when you have living things in a liquid, it becomes quite complex to keep them alive.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So how do you generally keep it stable? Like if you're going to ship it and stuff, because it's going to sit in the sun and all that.
So it's kind of a bit of a secret, but
sure.
A big part of it is a process where we are selecting the kinds of microbes we want. So what we're doing is we're taking the worm tea, which has all these random microbes living in it, which mm-hmm. is impacted by, yes, the diet of the worms, which is somewhat controlled, but also just by sheer luck and happenstance. And, you know, you can never keep a worm bin microbiologically pure. So other things will end up in there. So we have to remove basically everything living from the worm tea, from the worm casting, and then on the side, breed the species we actually want and bring them back in. And so this allows for a controlled, consistent microbiome, and it also allows you to use microbes which are capable of going into hibernative stasis. And those hibernating microbes are much hardier and much more capable of surviving long periods of time without oxygen, without nutrients, without access to soil. So they can float around in the liquid medium until they get to the soil, upon which they will begin to activate, to bloom, to blossom, to breed, to reproduce, colonize that soil, anchor themselves into the roots, form that Hartig net, and provide the soil with the kind of living matrix it needs to be productive.
Right. Yeah. So what's it look like if something is over nitrogen, you know, nitrogen poisoned, you were talking about on your website?
Yes. So nitrogen poisoning is an increasingly common phenomenon, and it's driven by this kind of negative feedback loop we were discussing a moment ago, which is that as we use more fertilizer, we end up killing more of the soil microbiology. We end up killing our detritivores, our earthworms, our isopods, our protozoa, and our bacteria and fungi. And as you do that, you end up with a situation where the soil gets less productive, and so the farmer uses more nitrogen. Because mm-hmm. the next season, he's not getting as much growth as he did last season. And this negative feedback loop continues. So to solve for this, we need to reduce the nitrogen load and bring life back. But if we don't, the kinds of symptoms we begin to see are those of nitrogen poisoning. So we're talking about seeing leaves starting to actually turn yellow near the edges, especially. You start to see a eutrophication in nearby water bodies. So what that means is algal blooms, duckweed blooms. So the nearby ponds and lakes start just popping off with very short-term blooms of life that end up choking all the oxygen out of those water bodies and killing your fish and killing your other animals that live there. On top of that, the other symptoms of nitrogen poisoning are eventually you start to see necrosis. You start to see plants actually taking in so much nitrogen salt that it is literally destroying their own cell membranes and cell walls. And that results in crinkling at the edges of leaves, browning, and finally the blackening. And finally, you will see plants just die. And they will, when a plant dies from nitrogen poisoning, it dies, it burns down to the ground. So it burns from the leaves out, or leaves in rather, and just burns its way down to the soil. And it happens very fast. And there's very little you can do to stop that once it's happened, because your soil is just full of nitrogen salt by that point. Similar symptoms can happen with phosphorus, although phosphorus is a little more malicious, because phosphorus not only can burn the plant, but phosphorus can also bond selectively to micronutrients in the soil. So it starts to form complexes like zinc phosphate, selenium phosphate, manganese phosphate. And those complexes are insoluble, which means it's not only poisoning the plant, but it's also depriving the soil of the micronutrients it has by making those micronutrients inaccessible. And this is such a major problem that in countries like India and China, there are tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of child mortality a year that can be directly attributed to the overuse of phosphorus fertilizer. Something like 4% of all child deaths in the world can be linked specifically to zinc deficiency driven by phosphorus fertilizer overuse. So children not getting enough zinc in India because they're eating rice that they expect to be, you know, nutritional, doesn't have enough zinc in it, and their immune system does not develop properly, and they die. And that's because of the overuse, really, of too much phosphorus, which is a frightening thing and a very dismotivating thing to think about.
Yeah, it's interesting when you like shoot plant this app at one of those say trees or whatever that have too much nitrogen, it goes, oh, it just needs more water. But you know, it just rained 5 inches over the last 2 days. So I don't think it's water.
I mean, and what happens when you use more water on a plant that has too much nitrogen? It needs water so that it can dilute the nitrogen and run it off and get it away from the plant. So it's solving too much nitrogen for the plant by intentionally creating runoff, which is not a good solution.
Right. And also, it doesn't create any real roots. It just makes shallow roots corn, you know.
Nitrogen creates very hollow growth in plants. Nitrogen is a key material used in the construction of proteins and chlorophyll, which makes the plant green and big. But you also need calcium. You also need phosphorus. You also need selenium and zinc and manganese and magnesium and sulfur and all these other things. And if you don't have those things, yeah, the plant will go really, really big. But it's like feeding a person hundreds of marshmallows. Yeah, they're going to get really big, but they're not going to be healthy. It's a steroid. It makes them bloom, but the actual underlying health is deficient. And we can equivocate this to foodstuffs, because when you look at the average orange of today, the average orange that you and I are eating is 6 times less nutritionally dense than the orange that was eaten in the 1960s. So that orange that you might have had 10 years ago was way better than the orange of today, and it's only getting worse. And because of that, we are eating the foods that our forefathers ate, that our parents and our grandparents and our great-parents ate in the same or even greater quantities, and being less, and getting less nutrition out of it, being less healthy, even though we're eating better. Which is that's upsetting. I don't know what to do about that. I mean, Wrigglebrew is a good piece to solving that puzzle. It helps regenerate soil, but it is not going to solve this on a global level. So it's something we as humanity need to think about and face very honestly.
That sounds good. I completely agree. So you are also, it's interesting looking at the bottle. It's like the NPK is 0.28, 0.1, and 0.05. Yes. And somebody's going to look at that and go, well, that's not enough, right? Because they're used to 5.5, 3, you know, whatever, right?
Yeah.
Or worse than that, 10.10.10. So
there's a lot of education that has to happen for people to understand that the three numbers on the bottle does not tell you how good it actually is for the soil for the plants.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Humic acid, for example, which is an extremely common component of Riggle Brew, has, on average, in a given humic acid molecule, 5 atoms of nitrogen, which is more nitrogen than in a piece of urea or ammonia, which will have 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
But it's locked inside a much larger molecule, so it wouldn't show up as part of the NPK analysis. The humic acid molecule is 185 atoms. Urea is like 5 atoms. So when you talk about available nitrogen, you're talking about urea. You're talking about ammonia. You're not talking about humic acid, which is way, way bigger. But humic acid is way better. It's a much better source of nitrogen because plants are able to get to the humic acid at the speed that they actually need. It's not just nitrogen everywhere. It's not like dropping someone into a, you know, a pigsty full of McDonald's french fries everywhere. It's like actually giving them a meal. So yes, there's less nitrogen, but the nitrogen that is there is much better. And that's a difficult thing to convey with just NPK. So there's a lot of education that has to happen, which is one of the reasons I'm grateful for being on your show. So I can talk about that and get people to start to think that there is much more to the health of your plants than just NPK. It's like looking at food just by the calories. You wouldn't look at a Snickers bar and say, oh, that has 280 calories in it. That's great. That's fantastic. That's better than this apple, which has 45 calories. But I think we all kind of intuitively understand which of those two is probably better for us.
Mm-hmm. Great. So if I'm getting ready to transplant some chestnut trees or whatever else, how would I go about using Riggle Brew? Do I mix it in with the soil? Do I use it as foliar spray, or what's the best way to go?
The best way to go is to get it towards the roots. Mm-hmm. That's the most effective way because that gets both the nutrients nearest to where the plant can absorb them and the actual biology nearest to where it can become symbiotic with the plant. We only recommend spraying when you have an established plant that's really struggling and you're seeing actual impacts on the leaves. Worm teas, compost teas, they are best used as a real true fertilizer. So that's in furrow, that's mixing with a watering can and pouring it at the base of your plant. It's fertigation, it's stuff like that. Foliar can work too, and in fact, I've seen it work really well on things like fungus gnats and spider mites and aphids and mealybugs and whiteflies and even fig rusts, but its best application is as a growth medium because an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of care, and this very much is the case with fertilizers. When you get something like Riggle Brew into the soil, it provides much more nutrition and health to the plant, and that means a stronger immune system. That means it's much more likely to ward off attacks by pathogens, parasites, and insects in the future without you having to go back and fix it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw the review on your website where it said some folks are using it as a foliar spray later on when they see those bugs or whatever else, and then when they spray it, the plant perks up.
Yes,
you know,
and there's stuff like that. Twofold reasons for that, which is they're kind of fascinating. One is that yes, it's providing nutrition to the plant, which is helping it fight. But two, perhaps more interesting biochemically, worm castings are chock full of what are called polyphenol compounds, mm-hmm. which are things like capsaicinoids, caffeic acid, tannins, flavonoids, things of that nature. Those compounds, when they coat a plant on its surface, the external surface of the plant, they disintegrate some of the mandibles of certain insects and they break down they cause them like deadly indigestion. For us, it's just like, oh, this is nothing. Like capsaicin makes pepper spicy for us. But for, you know, like a weevil, biting into a spicy pepper is like a death sentence. And it's these same compounds that earthworms intentionally put into their castings. I say intentionally, you know, biochemically intentionally put into their castings so that the castings that they produce help defend plants so that their children and themselves will have more leaf litter to eat in the future. It's a very symbiotic process. And as a consequence, worm teas studies have shown seem to have pesticidal impacts. They're not pesticides, but studies have shown that they reduce pest populations in a lot of cases. So there is a world where you can use both, or rather you can use a worm tea to do both without having to buy both products, which is a captivating idea for a place to be for us.
Yeah, that sounds great. So you also have something called soil and yes. Vermicompost, right? What, how's that differ?
It's another tongue twister, but it's just worm castings for the most part, but we do add chitin to them, and chitin, That's the shell of lobster and crab.
Uh-huh.
It's what makes up their exoskeleton, which lobsters and crabs are arthropods, just like mealybugs, just like spider mites. Those guys are all arthropods as well. Plants have adapted many mechanisms to react to chitin. They produce an enzyme chitinase that kicks their immune system into high gear as soon as chitin is detected. And so by having a little dose of that in the worm castings, what it does is it gives the plant a bit of a heightened sense of awareness and a heightened immune response, which is actually quite useful because we're also giving it, through the worm castings, a bunch of nutrients. So we're not only giving it a lot to grow on, we're also saying, grow a lot and be on higher alert, which tends to result in the plant being a lot more hardy, a lot more self-defensible, a lot more able to fight off various kinds of diseases and pests and so forth. So it's a fortified worm casting, a worm casting that punches a little harder, that hits a little heavier.
Mm-hmm. And then the bacteria will fight off the bad bacteria. The good bacteria will fight off the bad bacteria.
Precisely. So when you have bacillus living in soil, they are natural producers of certain antibiotics, which mm-hmm. means it helps them fight off a lot of those gram-negative, you know, agrobacterium and things of that nature. Those infectious bacteria.
Right. Yeah, that's good. So the Wriggle Brew is in bottles. Is it concentrated? Do you mix it up with a gallon of water, or what do you do?
Precisely. Yeah. I mean, that's the best way to do it. You get the most of your money's worth. When you mix it with water, you are able to put it into a watering program. So like if you're watering your plants every 10 days or 20 days or whatever, this is something where you can pour it out there because you've just mixed it in with your water a little bit. Each bottle, each 32-ounce bottle, turns into roughly 8 gallons of fertilizer, depending on how you use it. So it can go quite a long ways. That's more than enough to feed a very large garden, like a large garden bed or backyard garden. Mm-hmm. And agricultural use, its rate is about 30 ounces to the acre for most crops. It's in about that range, which is a really, really good rate when you consider that a 32-ounce bottle is like $20. So if you want to feed an entire acre for like $20, that's a pretty good deal.
That's awesome. That's great. And then another thing you were saying is that you're also doing research, or you're participating in a study to break down plastic. Is that right? Tell me a little bit more about that.
And I think that's the final and most possibly most efficacious or impactful part of what we're doing that I'll talk about tonight. And mm-hmm. that is our work. We were funded by the National Science Foundation to pursue this in using worm microbes to digest plastics. So a lot of the actual bacteria that live in and around earthworms have also been observed in other contexts, breaking down certain kinds of polymers. So that's things like polystyrene. So that's styrofoam. That's things like LDPE, like plastic bag plastic. So there are worms like larval worms that actually have been seen not only with these bacteria in them, but actually eating these plastics and using these bacteria to digest them. It's not common. It only mm-hmm. happens really when these organisms are like starving and are around lots of these plastics. But there actually is a biochemical pathway by which they are digesting plastic. It's very slow. So we proposed to the NSF an idea, which was take these worms, get the bacteria out of them, isolate those bacteria, set up big bioreactors. So basically an artificial worm gut. I actually have a broken bioreactor right here. So a big glass vessel like this, fill it with a bunch of these bacteria, and then feed plastic into this big artificial worm gut and see if that will allow us to digest a lot more plastic and potentially a lot faster. And through our study, we determined that yes, that does work. But more so, we found that as the worm gut, as the bioreactor digests the plastic, what it turns that plastic into is a series of biodegradable materials, which are edible by earthworms. And that means we can take those and feed those to earthworms and end up turning the plastic into worm castings. Now, we haven't deployed this on a large scale yet. This is very much developmental at the moment. But that means there's a possible reality not far off where we could be collecting large amounts of plastic waste, plastic bags, styrofoam, stuff of that nature, and digesting it into worm castings, which is topsoil, which is a resource we're losing in this country. And I mean, imagine turning landfills into topsoil. That's what we're talking about. it's still far ways off, but we have seen that it works biochemically. So right now we're in the process of trying to raise a little more funding so we can set up a pilot with some of our local grocery stores to take their plastic and turn it into castings.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
It's cool.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. So how do I get Wriggle Brew? What's the best way to get it? Straight from your website or where's it?
Definitely from the website. Yeah, that's okay. That works best. We are on Amazon. So if you got a Prime membership or whatever, you can get it that way. But I definitely recommend wrigglebrew.com. Mm-hmm. We also have a lot of information about our research there. So if you're interested in learning more, it's a good resource. That's WRIGGLEBREW, wrigglebrew.com. And yeah, it's a great place to hang out if you're interested in getting some worm poop and worm juice and helping our research project with this plastic.
That sounds great. Thanks, Sam.
Oh, thanks for having me, Scott. This was a fun conversation.
Yeah, excellent interview. Thank you.
If you like this episode, leave us a tip on Venmo or Cash App at Thrive in the Future. You can also go to our stuff page and buy some stuff, or go to grownuttrees.com and buy some trees. And I now have a Substack. It's thriveinthefuturesubstack.com. And that's where I post some of the articles that were on Thriving News, some of the things written by Perpend, as well as I post these episodes over there as well. So go over there, subscribe. That's at thriveinthefuture.substack.com. Thank you for listening to Thrive in the Future podcast. If you like what you hear, please click that like or subscribe button in your favorite podcast app. Follow us on Twitter @ThriveInTheFute and also go to thriveinthefuture.com.